is a very important question on the left, you know, especially since sexism has been around since before capitalism. It's something that's argued that it cannot be eliminated by sexism or socialism. I'm all confused with the S's today. I'm really sorry. But I'm going to go ahead and introduce Jessie Muldoon, who's a teacher and ISO member from Oakland. And she'll be kicking it off. So.
Okay. So we were supposed to be in the Audre Lorde room, but there was a scheduling mishap. So the Audre Lorde room is being used by a group that helps girls and young women do outdoor activities and stuff like that, camping. So you can't really oppose that. But I did wanted to start with a quote from Audre Lorde, because she was a fantastic feminist poet activist. And I think it's a very apt quote, even though we're in Women's Building B. Sometimes we're blessed with being able to choose the time and the arena and the manner of our revolution. But more usually, we must do battle where we are standing. And I think that really touches on a lot of the themes of this weekend, that we want systemic change, we want revolutionary change, we want to upend the system and create it anew. We also have to battle where we're standing. We have to battle against sexism, against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, against racism, against immigrant bashing, and against rigid gender norms and all of that. So I thought that was a really nice quote to start with. So the question is, will socialism end sexism? And I'm going to now move on to another quote from a Russian revolutionary, Inessa Armand. She said, "If women's liberation is unthinkable without communism, then communism is unthinkable without women's liberation." So will socialism liberate women? Well, women and men, struggle and revolution will liberate all of humanity. If capitalism uses the economy and social and cultural institutions to oppress women, it also uses those same tools to sexually repress everyone. While women are specifically oppressed as women, I want to throw out that forcing a binary set of gender roles onto all of humanity is also oppressive, and the struggle for women's liberation is linked to the struggle for sexual liberation. Can I use that as a podium? Is that
that?
Cool? Sorry. I can't see far enough. Yeah, that's perfect. Information on the podium, that's great. So where do we stand now? I'm sure we can all agree that society is extremely sexist. Pick your poison. What do you despise the most? Diet ads? Thin thighs in 12 seconds a day? Flatten your belly on a cayenne pepper power cleanse? These things really exist. The competition between women on these like crazy shows like Desperate Housewives and then The Real Housewives of New Jersey. These insane body ideals. And I read one of the books that I like is Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth. And she describes two different ideal body images. One is a woman who's extremely gaunt with really big breasts, and a woman who's extremely muscular with really big breasts. So the theme, you can see the theme, but as the author points out, neither of those body types are commonly found in nature. And then there's raunch culture, which people may be familiar with. Ariel Levy wrote a book called Female Chauvinist Pigs, which is a really interesting book where she talks about the idea that you can transcend sexism by kind of embracing it. So I think that a really weird example is the Feministing website, which is says a lot of really good things. Its logo is those two silhouetted, big-busted women back-to-back, you know, which people wear on jackets, which I think originated as mud flaps on 18-wheelers. And I think that embracing sexism to transcend it, that kind of hipster, ironic way of doing it, is really, I find it really odious. Then there's also, I don't know if people think this, but I always find it funny when you watch TV and you see these insane barrage of yogurt ads. Like, women are obsessed with yogurt. You know? ounce containers of yogurt. Like, it's just this weird, I don't know, that's just sort of something I think is funny. But it's true. We've been reduced to, like, raunch culture and yogurt. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge there has been progress. It's been contradictory at best, but there has been progress. There are more women in management, more women in politics, and other positions of power. But at the same time, there's a crisis in healthcare. Disproportionate poverty for single mothers. Child care is inadequate, if not unavailable, for poor working class women. In the International Labor Organization did a study in the last few years, I can't remember exactly when it was, that it talks about maternity leave. I looked at maternity leave. More than 120 countries around the world provide paid maternity leave and health benefits by law, including most industrialized countries, except Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. And then they go on to say, in all parts of the world, working women who become pregnant are faced with a threat of job loss, suspended earnings, and increased health risks due to inadequate safeguards for their employment. And later on in the report, they say, in just over 10 years, 80% of all women in industrialized countries and 70% globally will be working outside the home during their child-rearing years. And yet, we don't have paid maternity leave in the United States. In a New York Times article, they did a series called Death in Birth about infant and maternal mortality rates. They say, so this is from May of this year in the New York Times, pregnancy and childbirth kill more than 536,000 women a year, more than half of them in Africa, according to some statistics, which show up on my paper. Most of the deaths are preventable with basic obstetrical care. Tanzania, with roughly 13,000 deaths annually, has neither the best nor the worst record in Africa. And the reason that they picked Tanzania is because it's they say it's politically stable and that the real problem is poverty. Poverty is the reason that that women and children are dying in childbirth. They say it's one of the world's poorest countries, suffering from almost every problem that contributes to high maternal death rates. Shortages of doctors, nurses, drugs, equipment, roads, and transportation. So poverty alone can make pregnancy and childbirth deadly in many parts of the world. And the same series documents the fatality rates of women dying by abortions not performed by medical doctors. And it's another argument. It was quite a shocking article, but it's yet another argument that abortion needs to be safe, legal, and available to anyone who needs it at any time for any reason. Abortion laws are increasingly restrictive, and abortions harder and harder to obtain. The recent assassination of Dr. Tiller in Kansas, rendering Kansas without a late-term, the entire state of Kansas without a late-term abortion provider, is chilling, but also a heartbreaking reminder that women's bodies are still not our own. And if you get a chance to listen to any of Dr. Tiller's speeches, he wasn't just an abortion provider. He was a women's rights activist. He would wear buttons that said "Trust Women," and a one that said "A woman's body is smarter than her doctor." It's a tragedy for the women's rights movement to lose such an amazing advocate. Women's wages still hover around 75 cents on a man's dollar, and with all wages falling as they do during a depression, this can only make matters worse for everybody. And as was brought up in Jillian's great talk on origins of sexism, when you counter in unpaid maternity leave, taking time off to take care of a sick child or an elder parent, women's wages actually can be depressed as far as 34 cents, if I remember correctly, around 30 to 40 cents on a man's dollar. It's crazy. So at the same time, there's more openness about sex, and more women may experience more freedom and control, but the rate and degree of exploitation is scary. There are more girls and women participating in school level and college sports thanks to Title IX, but Title IX, a law, a policy, can't do away with class inequities. Another New York Times article talked about in suburban, more affluent suburban areas, women and boys participate in sports almost equally. But when you take into consideration, I think they did a study of a girls' basketball team in the Bronx, where the economic pressures on the families to use middle school age girls as child care, as picking up their siblings, as being home with an elder adult in the home, actually cuts dramatically into girls' abilities to participate fully in sports, in spite of a good law. At the same time, girls and women suffer from a host of distorted body image issues, dysfunctional solutions, eating disorders, plastic surgery, breast enhancement, breast reduction. I'm not dissing any woman who does these things. I'm saying that society's pressures force women to force external solutions onto their bodies. Not to mention the millions of dollars of women spend every year on age reduction creams, anti-wrinkle creams, creams and lotions that promise to take 10 years off your skin, revitalize your skin, reduce the signs of aging, et cetera, et cetera. And even, I think even more disturbing than that is that it's cutting. Lots of young women cutting because they're just, the pressures of being a young woman in the society are so intense. I mentioned eating disorders. There are a lot of self-destructive behaviors that are still going on in spite of the progress that I mentioned. In the past, women may have been described as the weaker or fairer sex, And that language sounds kind of outdated, and it is, but the concepts actually persist. Women aren't weaker, just more sensitive and nurturing. And it's really mothering that fulfills us. And if you think these ideas are outdated, read a parenting magazine. They're called parenting, but they shouldn't be. They should be called mothering, and maybe a little bit of fathering, but really, you're kind of a liability. Or a baby-rearing book. They're just, they can be, all except for Hip Mama, which was the only one I found that wasn't really pretty bad. The ideas haven't disappeared. They've been repackaged. So this is an ad from, I think it was just Parents or Parenting. So it's a T-Mobile ad, and some people may have heard me use this anecdote before. And it's the woman saying, I bring my T-Mobile cell phone whenever I go for a run because I get a call at least once a mile. And I'm like, would your husband lose the kids? You know, I can't remember where I put the food. The baby's gone. You know, like she can't run a mile without a phone call from home. And then the other one, and that's just kind of dopey. Good. But then there was another research-based study that said women in maternity wards, when blindfolded, can sniff out, smell, identify by scent their own children. And I'm kind of like, again, like, how did you do this research? You know, we're going to blindfold. You just had birth, 12 hours ago. We're going to hide your babies. Blindfold you. I mean, it's just complete nonsense. It totally feeds into the idea that women are, especially sensitive to their own children. And it's just complete lunacy. There's also the phenomenon of the celebrity mom and how they have it all. I mean, how do you manage when you have a SWAT team of nannies? How did you get your pre-pregnancy body back without a personal trainer, you know? The Mommy Myth is a great, hilarious, but also very good book about the new momism and moms in... A very class conscious, very good book about what real life parenting looks like. And I bring it up not to be funny, just funny, because it is funny, but because I think this type of media can be really distorting. Just as comparing yourself to Kate Moss or some other emaciated model sets you up to fail, the image of the mother who can have it all does the same. Beauty, wealth, career, family, what's wrong with you? If you can't do it too, it's a double standard. If Angelina Jolie or any prominent Hollywood mom declared she wanted to take some time off to be with her children, the fawning media would laud her for it. Oh, what a great mother. But when a poor woman or a woman of color, or especially a woman of color, is unemployed, perhaps receiving assistance, and God forbid has a child, she's living off the system. A welfare mom or a welfare queen, and no one's out to praise her for making the choice to stay home to nurture her children. And don't make the mistake of taking me for pitting women against each other, because I think enough of them, the media does enough of that as it is, especially around parenting. Mom versus mom, the mommy wars, moms who stay at home versus moms who work, who's the good mom and who's the evil mom, all that kind of stuff. I'm arguing that the perfect celebrity mom is to the poor and working class mom what the image of the perpetually thin and fit model is to women in general, an idealized sexist standard to which most women cannot live up. And then there's pop culture. Bitches and hoes, bitch slap, all that stuff, Halloween costumes, beauty pageants. Had the extreme misfortune to see a Girls Gone Wild ad, I think Friday night, and it was just, it was just disgusting, but it's also especially disgusting if you know that the producers of Girls Gone Wild specifically go out, get young women loaded, tell them they're going to be models. Mm-hmm. This is their ticket. They are going to be on, they're going to be famous models, and this is the trajectory that this is where they need to start. It's really just, it's disgusting. So what does all this do to women's consciousness? It shouldn't take a well-funded think tank to figure out how it impacts confidence and self-esteem. Girls from an early age are judged by their looks and how well they conform to a particular way of looking. As I mentioned before, sexual liberation is linked to women's liberation because strict gender roles harm us all. Think of all the expectations and limits heaped on boys and girls. Girls are tomboys if they play sports and don't want to wear pink. And that's probably much more accessible, acceptable. Actually, Sherry argues in her book that these days it's more acceptable for a girl to be a tomboy than a boy to be a quote-unquote sissy. That is not conforming to prescribed definitions and standards of masculinity. And there's an inordinate amount of overt marketing that goes into enforcing strict gender roles. Barbies and Disney princesses on the one hand, Hot Wheels and G.I. Joe on the other. And I think we can all think, you can all think of 100 different products that are marketed on kids' TV. My daughter has this, I thought, very gender-neutral toy. It's called Pixos, and they're these little balls that you build things out of, and then you spray them, and you can do anything with them. It's like Legos or Life Brights, like But now they have ones for girls, and they're called Chixos. And I thought she was kidding when she told me. I was like, you're just you're teasing me, because you know I think that would be crazy. But then I saw the ad, and it's true. Pixos are for boys, Chixos are for girls. It's bizarre. But that's overt. That's media. We see that every day, and it's identifiable. But there's also something more subtle, the discussion of what's innate and versus what's environmental. And there's a lot of, you know, the women are for Venus, men are for Mars kind of thing. Like, there are just these differences we have, and we should embrace the differences. And there's a lot of talk about this from perfectly progressive folks perplexed about the differences they see between their own male and female children. I'm not saying there aren't some. I'm not a scientist, so I can't go through the role of, you know, hormones and stuff like that. But I want to emphasize the nurture part of it, the environmental part of it. There was a little essay in the New York Times recently that had this guy, and he's like, I consider myself a liberal. I don't try to enforce gender norms. So I went to the park. My little girl, there's a duck. My little girl says, oh, look at the ducky. My little boy says, I'm going to throw a rock at the ducky. And he's like, what do I make of this? I don't feel like I enforce these gender norms. And so it makes people think, you know, isn't there just something to it? And I think yes and no, but I think that as a teacher, what I see, as I, last couple of years I've been teaching preschool and kindergarten, boys will play in the kitchen and girls will build bridges with blocks if you encourage them to do so. But you have to look deeper and not just question what's reinforced in small children and what's not on a much subtler level. So the evil marketers, the Chixos, the Pixos, there's that. But then there's also a much more subtle reinforcement that I think goes on, and I don't think it's malevolent. I don't think it's meant to be harmful. For example, these are all things that, you know, you hear every day. Oh, how's the princess today? Ooh, what a strong little guy. Or, and on that, those are like compliments, gender-based compliments. More negatively, that's not ladylike. Or, this happened in my classroom. One of my coworkers told a little boy not to take the pink piece of paper, because pink is for girls, so pick a different color. And I even experienced that as having a daughter, that if I take if my daughter dresses up, like, you know, because she likes to dress up, and she gets a lot of feedback, oh, you look so beautiful, little princess, you know. And that starts at such a young age that I think it actually shapes gender identity and norms really, really young, in a way that you don't, and it's well-meaning. I've all three compliments, I think, is well-meaning. But you don't, I think the effects, it looks very subtle, but the effects are very dramatic. As Sherry said in her book, as every parent eventually discovers to one degree or another, the world will eventually have its way with your child. So, but what about the children who don't conform to these standards? You better hope they live in really supportive and diverse communities, but too many do not. Violence against children who do not conform, against transgendered children, the violence that kids face is at an increasingly high rate. Sexual assaults of girls and women is extremely high. I'm sure most people are familiar with who Gwen Araujo was. She was killed while at a party when her attackers discovered she was actually biologically male and not female. And they tried to use this sort of, like, I freaked out, oh my God, I'm so, like, the gay panic kind of thing as part of their defense. So as I've suggested, strict gender roles enforce limits on all people. And sexism trickles down to impact girls' lives from the get-go. We live in a society where youth is not merely worshipped, it's also sexualized more and more at a younger and younger age. There's a good article in Rethinking Schools, because this is, you know, it was about a teacher kind of grappling with, it was called Six Going on 16, and the kinds of language and body issue things that the girls were experiencing, and the boys too, she was shocked at how young an age it was beginning. And this is an excerpt from a book called So Sexy, So Soon. Excuse me. So Sexy, So Soon by Diane Levin. Jennifer reported that one evening not long ago, her 7-year-old daughter, Hannah, began crying in the bathtub. Alarmed, Jennifer asked what was wrong. Hannah responded, I'm fat, I'm fat. I want to be pretty like Isabel, sexy like her. Then Judd would like me too. Seven years old. Jennifer knew Isabel, a very thin, very popular girl in Hannah's class who wore quote-unquote stylish clothes that Jennifer thought was inappropriate for a 7-year-old. Jennifer put her hand on Hannah's shoulder and said she liked Hannah's body. It was a wonderful body for a 7-year-old, and she certainly didn't think she needed to lose weight. But Hannah continued to cry and say she wanted to go on a diet. Jennifer didn't know, felt uncertain about what to do or say next. In her view, Hannah had a perfectly normal body for a 7-year-old girl. Jennifer thought it must be abnormal for such a young child to be thinking about diets. letting alone wanting boys to like her for being pretty or sexy. So there's a slight moralistic tone to that. You know, maybe it's the other mother's fault. But in spite of that, this example is repeated daily across the country, I have no doubt. The trickling down of sexism, sexuality, and body image issues to a younger and younger audience. And there are a slew of parenting books that talk about this, the challenges of raising children in a heavily marketed and advertised world. And it is hard. I mean, you're like, you know, what are you going to do? To counter the sexualizing of children. But there's another response, and I think a much more reactionary one, and that's the abstinence movement.
Mm-hmm.
People may have heard of the purity balls.
I know.
I don't let my daughter watch the Jonas Brothers.
Yeah.
I like watching Buffy. So purity balls are large prom-like events, complete with 7-foot-tall crosses carried by girls dressed as ballerinas. They carry these giant wooden crosses, and I mean, it's crazy. There are these slideshows available on Time's website and the New Time Magazine's website and the New York Times website. How am I doing on time?
You're gone.
Oh, I'm for
20 minutes.
Okay.
You're halfway there.
I'm good.
Just then.
So these girls carry out these crosses. There are these young men carry like huge swords in a form of a cross. And what the point of these are that fathers take their daughters, and according to the articles, ages 4 to about college age, to these balls to protect their purity and their virginity until they enter into a heterosexual marriage, at which time the dad signs the girl over to a new protector, a husband. And according to an article about purity balls in a recent New York Times, I can't laugh without saying purity balls. Too. So this is a quote from the father. And if you look at these pictures, super wealthy, upper middle class, all white. I mean, these are like proms. And you know how expensive a prom is? But it's self-funded by these families to protect their children. So this is what one of the dads said. Says he is taking a 16-year-old there. It inspires me. Oh, it's also good for me, he says. It inspires me to be spiritual and moral in turn. If I'm holding them, the daughters, to such high standards, you can be sure I won't be cheating on their mother.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
Great. So that's a funny one. This is a little more disturbing of a quote. This is from a 13-year-old describing the ceremony. We discussed what it means to be a teenager in today's world, she said. They, the fathers, gave her a charm for her bracelet, a lock in the shape of a heart. Her father has the key. The girl says, on my wedding day, he'll give it to my husband, she explains. That's disturbing and sad that the girl is under lock and key from her father until she enters into an acceptable heterosexual marriage at some point in her life. The girls are under lock and key literally from their fathers and then their husbands. And they've been criticized even from Christians. This is in the Chicago Sun-Times. A columnist, Betsy Hart, says, look, I'm an evangelical Christian who firmly believes that sex should be reserved for marriage, but I just can't imagine going about it this way with any of my 4 sons or daughters. For starters, something like a purity ball essentially minimizes a young woman's very humanity. But of course, if we value her and we know that her sexuality and her choices she makes about it are, as an adult, are hers. Besides, I can't help but wonder if a single-minded focus on virginity is an ironic and unintended way of sexualizing youth in another way. And I think that that's really true. And in fact, we probably all know the statistics that kids who pledge abstinence are as likely to have sex as kids who don't. They're just more likely to get STDs and pregnant.
That's,
you know,
right.
It's just that the risks are higher. And then in Eve Ensler, she wrote the Vagina Monologue. She criticizes the purity balls too. She says, when you sign a pledge to your father to preserve your virginity, your sexuality is basically being taken away from you until you sign yet another contract, a marital one. It makes you feel like you're the least important person in the whole equation.
That's right.
I think that nails it right on the head. So from abstinent balls to rigid gender norms to increasingly sexually suggestive clothes for little girls, there's clearly a mixed message about that's being directed at our children, and it's no wonder that there's so much confusion, alienation, and miseducation about sex. So where is the movement against sexism for women's liberation and sexual liberation? Because clearly we need a movement. In the 60s and 70s, the women's rights movement took up many of these issues. They linked opposing sexist images to class demands like equal rights in the workplace, equal pay for equal work, free abortion on demand, subsidized child care. Everybody has our bodies ourselves. This is an anecdote from when I was a little kid. My parents had stickers. I said this in Jillian's meeting too, but my parents had stickers that were very common at the time that you would put on a sexist image. It said, "This insults women."
Yeah.
And they also protested. They protested the Miss America pageant. My parents and their friends protested them. It was either Miss Maine or Miss America, I'm not sure. So they had the Mr. Maine pageant, and the talent competitions was changing babies' diapers. So that was like 1970, 71. Like the idea that just knee-jerk opposition to sexism existed at a certain point of time is, those are funny examples, but that's my point, is that there used to be a time when you didn't just kind of sit through a Girls Gone Wild ad, you would protest it.
Right.
So the first step in building a movement is building solidarity. Understanding the fight that's for single payer is a women's rights issue. The ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and fights against poverty, for example, I referred to the Tanzania article. Those are women's rights issues. And using the new LGBT struggle as an example, I think hats off for putting transgender folks at the front, recognizing that we all have allies in the struggles that we fight in. We'll have many male allies in the struggle for women's liberation. And some will be with us because they morally oppose oppression. They think it's odious, and they want to help stop it. But there's another reason that I think men will and should join the struggle against women's oppression is because they actually, no one in the working class benefits from another's oppression. It's simplified by saying an injury to one is an injury at all. But actually, when you think about it, it's actually true. All members of the working class. They understand that all members of the working class will benefit from fighting against a system of capitalism, reorganizing society anew. So I want to talk about that idea that no one in the working class benefits from another's oppression. That is to say, and I'll maybe say it a little more clearly, working class men do not, in fact, benefit from women's oppression. And that might sound a little counterintuitive. Well, of course men benefit. If I get paid less and you get paid more, I suffer, you benefit. I mean, it makes sense on a certain level, but if you take it apart a little bit more, I think that you'll see that it's not exactly true. On a day-to-day basis, it can look like men have it better off. They receive some benefits from their gender, as it appears. Sexual harassment in the workplace, job discrimination, getting passed over for promotions, facing institutional discouragement from entering certain fields. Or more subtle educations, more subtle examples, public education. While women may be pretty well represented in public education, women are dominant in early childhood and lower elementary, and it's more even at upper, you know, at the secondary, but where you're paid less is actually early childhood. So one of the most crucial periods in a child's education is both dominated by women and one of the most devalued in the public education system, and I don't think that that's a coincidence. And we need to scratch even a little more deeply. We need to look at the entirety of the working class and its interests. Using women's oppression and sexism to pit workers who should otherwise be allies against each other ultimately and most significantly benefits the ruling class. The working class is divided amongst itself, which serves the interests of the capitalists, the ruling class, and not individual men. Economically speaking, as women have entered the workforce, competition between men and women drives wages down and not up. And the other way to ask this question is, do working class men have an interest in fighting against women's oppression? And if class unity between men and women can be used to wage a struggle against the ruling class, then the answer is absolutely yes. Like I said before, an injury to one is an injury to all. I'm going to have a long quote, so. Get some water. English socialist Lindsay German puts it this way. To argue that men have such an interest, that is, in perpetuating sexism, leads away from a class analysis of women's oppression. It's in the overwhelming interest of the working class to fight for the overthrow of the society, which exploits them, and therefore their fight for, among other things, their liberation of women. It's in the interest of the capitalist class, on the other hand, for labor power to be reproduced privately, for women to labor inside and outside the home, being paid low wages for work outside and nothing for domestic labor. This situation leads to unequal relationships between the sexes and within the family, but it does not lead to a situation where the man benefits. On the contrary, all members of society, of the family would benefit from being able to live in a society where relationships were not straitjacketed as they are at present. And I think that that's a great term, straitjacketed. A society where relations are straitjacketed, sexuality is straitjacketed, and gender roles are straitjacketed. So the question is it possible to have a society that's free of this? Plenty of anthropological evidence suggests that human societies have lived in all kinds of different relationships. There's this great book. It's very similar. It uses a lot of the same examples as The Myths of Male Dominance to show that around the world, human relations have existed in many, many different forms, not simply just the nuclear family. It's called Marriage, A History. It's funny. It's good. And Alfred Kinsey, the sexologist, which, you know, what a job, developed a scale that suggests that human sexuality exists on a 7-point continuum from totally hetero to totally homosexual, with most of the scale in between. Actually, most of the scale is in between those two poles. And he says about this, it should be pointed out that scientific judgments on this point, if he's talking about effeminacy in men, have been based on little more than the same sort of impression which the general public has concerning homosexual persons. Males do not represent two discrete populations, heterosexual or homosexual. The world is not divided into sheep and goats. Not all things are black and not all things are white. It's a fundamental of taxonomy that human nature rarely deals with discrete categories. Only the human mind invents categories and tries to force facts into separated pigeonholes. The living world is a continuum in each and every one of its aspects. The sooner we learn this concerning sexual human behavior, the sooner we shall reach a sound understanding of the realities of sex. And I think that's a really much more open way of looking at all the possibilities of being on a continuum versus, you know, you're here, and if you don't fit in, well, you know, good luck. So think of all the possibilities for humans to fully develop when they don't have to be boys or girls or men and women, when we don't have to feel bad about any part of our bodies, from our weight to our age to our femininity or our masculinity. A lot of what women's rights activists have talked about and do talk about is equality. There was the Equal Rights Amendment, equal pay for equal work, and equality is an important and noble and important call. But in a capitalist society, it's only a piece of the puzzle. Demanding equal wages, access to abortion as well as maternity leave, freedom from sexual assault and rape are crucial demands for a women's liberation movement, and socialists are involved in all of these struggles. While we're revolutionary, we never assume that the revolution will just come along and straighten everything out. For this reason, we organize now, we fight sexism in all arenas, including in our own movements, and argue for women's leadership in movements. And as Lenin talked about in I think What Is to Be Done, that you need to fight oppression no matter what class is hurt by it. So, and I want to... You give an example of that. Wherever you need to fight oppression, no matter the class, wherever you see it. And so that means taking up sexism where you see it, including the ruling class. So my example is Hillary Clinton during the campaign. So it's a slightly outdated example now, but, you know, just think back a year or so. She faced a lot of sexism when she was on the campaign trail, and that's not acceptable. Yeah. She's in the ruling class. When at the end of the day, she benefits from, you know, the oppression of her, of the, you know, the women who work for her. But we also have to oppose the sexism that was completely acceptable in the mainstream media characterizations of her and attacks on her because of her gender. And we need to link women's liberation with the liberation of all of humanity. As Marxists, we're dialectical, and that just means that we are shaped by the material conditions that we live in, and then we also shape them back. That's why we participate in the struggles now. Like the Audre Lorde quote, we battle where we stand, but we also, so we can win struggle, we can win changes in the immediate, but that can be the basis, the training ground, whatever you want to call it, for the larger struggles when we fight for actual real systemic change. And there are some very exciting glimpses into what a struggle for liberation, of all of human liberation, could look like. There, the role of women in the Paris Commune, the book The Women Incendiaries, the role of women in the Flint sit-down strikes, which helped form the CIO, Janora Johnson's pamphlet on the sit-down strikes and the women's auxiliary. And there was some really, really interesting stuff that's out there. And I want to talk for a second about the Russian Revolution. Alexander Kollontai, she started right away with the idea that you need to organize women, but not just women. You need to organize women on a class basis. And she actually, I mean, it sounds very current when you read it. She talks about feminists versus the need for working class women, and feminists as amongst classes versus the need for working class women to have a separate agenda or strategy. And that's my place. And what happened in the Russian Revolution is they didn't just say, okay, great, we're going to have a revolution and sweep away sexism. They actually implemented policies. Women's liberation was part of the program, and there were actual policies. The women's department, which I can't pronounce in Russian. Oh, am I okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The women's department actually made up concrete demands. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't just that the revolution would take care of it. They said, we want nurseries. We want access to, political organization. We want communal kitchens and all of that stuff. It was a revolutionary expression of the struggle for women's liberation, which links the struggle against all oppressions. And I'm going to quote a little bit from Sharon Smith's book. Has a really good section at the end on the Russian Revolution. This is Sharon. The revolutionary government enacted decrees that established full social and political equality for women. The right to vote and hold public office, the principle of equal pay for equal work, paid maternity leave for 4 months before and after childbirth, and child care at government expense. By 1920, legislation was passed that regarded abortion simply as a health matter, and women won the right to obtain free abortions in state hospitals. And there's a lot more examples in the book. They took up support for the Red Army, promotion of education and literacy for women, and the aim of involving larger numbers of women in politics. But Lenin actually, in 1919, made a very important observation, which laws are not enough, and we are by no means content with mere decrees. The laws were the step in the right direction, but you actually had to build a society based on these ideas. And what unfortunately happened is that by the fact that they were fighting the Civil War at the time, eventually with the ascension of Stalin, a lot of these roles were actually pushed back, and a lot more typical women's role was more enacted. So what will it be like when we take the straitjackets off and we're neither sexualized by the media nor victims of repressive right-wing anti-sex propaganda? When Kinsey's continuum is accepted societally, when dressing like a girl or be a man or you throw like a girl are anachronisms that make you laugh, like literally when the straitjackets are off. I'm ending now. I'm going to end with a quote from Engels and with a couple of my additions, and people may not be familiar with this quote. What we can now conjecture about the way in which sexual relations will be ordered after the impending overthrow of capitalist production is mainly of a negative character, limited for the most part of what will disappear. Girls Gone Wild, Cosmopolitan, everybody make a list of the first 10 things they want banned by the revolutionary. I think that alone would be interesting. But what will there be new? That will be answered when a new generation has grown up. A generation of men who never in their lives have known what it is to buy a woman's surrender with money or any other social instrument of power. A generation of women who have never known what it is to give themselves to a man for any other consideration than real love, or refuse to give themselves to their lover for fear of an economic consequence. And more of an update, a generation of girls who don't compare their body to a model's, or a generation of women who don't just laugh along with a sexist comment or inappropriate touch at work out of fear for losing a job, a much-needed job. A generation of boys who aren't called faggot or homo because they don't conform to standards of masculinity. When these people are in the world, they will care precious little about our list of our top 10 things. They will care precious little about what anybody today thinks they ought to do. They will make their own practice and their corresponding public opinion about the practice of each individual, and that will be the end of it. And the last quote I'm going to end with is the one I started with. If women's liberation is unthinkable without communism, then communism is unthinkable without women's liberation. So we need to struggle for both.
Discussion. And I'm going to start off. I see some people's hands. Good. Keep them raised for now as I'm still talking. I'm going to keep people at about 2.5 minutes, and I'll probably shorten it to 2 minutes somewhere during the discussion, since I imagine this will be a lively one. And I think I saw your hand go up first, and then you, and then you.
My name is Celeste Pulekin. It was really funny that you mentioned the stickers, the This Insults Women stickers, because we do. About a year ago, you're saying, like, if there was a list of things that you would ban, the first thing I would ban would be Tom Ford, because I'd say about a year and a half ago, he did a line of advertisements for his cologne, or for Men, which featured women shaved, oiled women, you know, like a picture from like here to here, women like pressing their breasts together with the perfume in between the breasts, like open mouths, like red lipstick, one in which like women's legs were spread, completely shaved, and the perfume is just, you know, in the crotch, you know. And I was really torn on like how to deal with this because, you know, there's like this idea of like playing into censorship and things like that. And what I did eventually do was make stickers that said sexism stinks, and then I'd go to places where the ads were and I'd put them on. Happy to know that that was a strategy that was used in the past, yeah. And I think we should really bring that back. Yeah. And then the second part was we were talking about the color pink and about transgender children. And there's actually a really good series that they did on NPR a little while ago, you might want to look up, where they talked about different families' reactions to their children being transgender. And they had, you know, two three-year-old kids. One family decided to roll with it, and one family decided to actively try and prevent the kid from expressing any transgender qualities.
30 seconds.
And it was really sad because the one kid that they tried to prevent it, what they did is they took away all his purple and pink crayons. And the kid actually stopped drawing altogether. And I think that it was heartbreaking, and really this story, and I'm like not like a proponent of NPR, but the story's like made me cry, and I really think that you should all check it out. So.
All right. I'm pretty sure that I got everyone, but if, you know, it goes on and I don't call your name, if I didn't make eye contact with you and then kind of nod, put your hand back up, and I'll point at you when I have you on the list. But next, I have Kendra, and then the woman with the red and black hair.
Okay, so let me just preface this by saying that I'm not judging anyone who's married, or obviously no judgment for the right for gay marriage, which I fully support. Obviously, anyone who wants to be married should be married. But what bothers me a lot about marriage is the fact that there's a stereotype that a woman is not considered successful unless she's married. Mm-hmm. Absolutely sickening.
That's right.
And it's not the same, like men can not be married and they're still, oh, but if a woman's not married, no matter what else she's done with her life, she's always described as being tragic, and I'm just totally sick of that.
Yeah.
Okay, you're next.
Hi, I'm Mary. I know, just like the stickers, we have to like bring them back. But also, we have to like bring back like the women's movement, like the women's like movement that's actually to like liberate. And I, one thing that I actually like in this movement that I want to like another, I guess, agreements or I guess a manner we have to like bring back is like teaching safe sex instead of abstinence, because like abstinence doesn't work. In reality, we see that like this, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's really backwards. So like, why don't we teach our kids like safe sex practice? If you're like either if you swing this way or that way, like how like our reproductive like system works, like the actual names of our reproductive system instead of just like another thing that I actually in the LGBT struggle with what's going on and like winning, like how we teach our children like different like family structures, I think that's like awesome, because like I know like it doesn't like it kind of like breaks like part that status quo, and it actually challenges status quo of like the nuclear family, where like it's only normal to like be in a like in a family where you only have like one like a mother and a father. But no, like I think it's like awesome like that this is actually kind of like being brought. This has been fought for, that we teach our children that, hey, it's a, like different kids come from like there's different types of like family structures. I think that's like just awesome, and we have to like bring back the movements, the women's like movement and the stickers, and teach like safe sex.
Okay. Next, I have you in the third row with the flag.
Yeah,
and red.
I just want to say something about why the quote about you can't have communism without women's liberation and women's liberation without communism because often it can seem like there's been sexism, but it's not immediately obvious how it's linked to the exploitation of the working class and the fact that we live in a capitalist society where the vast majority of people are oppressed. So they'll go to work every day and produce wealth for a boss. And I think part of it is the family. Obviously, in order for the working class to keep new generations, brought up, for people to be socialised, accepting the authority and the superiority of the bosses and the people that run society, the family is an essential institution. But also that in order to get workers to keep going to work every day, do what they're told, respect the authority of the boss, oppression is really useful, making people feel like there's something wrong with me, that the misery that I experience in my everyday life, my lack of control over the world, is because I don't live up to these stereotypes, my sexuality doesn't seem to accord with what's expected, I can't maintain a monogamous relationship that goes on for infinity. And if people feel as though they've failed, that is a way of internalising and making people accept that the society that they're locked with, they can't do anything about. And I think that, seeing how that's linked to these ideas are necessary in a world where the vast majority have to be exploited, that the bosses can't just say, oh, you're all just idiots, we're born to run things, you have to put up with it. They have all these complicated mechanisms for forcing people to accept this, and so that's why I think the fight for women's liberation is inextricably linked to the fight for the worker of the working class to overthrow the capitalists, and vice versa, and we should never accept that there's any separation between the two. Mm-hmm. And that's also why it's really important that working class women see that they don't have everything in common with working class women.
All right. Up next, we have the brown and green hat in the front.
All right. No, just...
Sorry.
Writing notes. Okay. First thing, you mentioned the slashing. And I'm wondering if anybody knows of a good book that talks about the slashing, talks about all the issues that reinforce that kind of stuff. And I don't need to have a discussion about it here. I think it's beyond our scope. There's a lot of other things we need to discuss here. And I certainly have a lot of personal. I know a lot about it, but I'd like to have a book that really goes into it. One, two. At Jillian's. Talk the other day, one of the comrades got up and mentioned the need for women-only, for the ability for women to meet in groups by themselves, okay? And I believe she got quite a bit of flack for that, and I would like people to, and I know there'll be some disagreement, but I would like people to think about this with an open mind, not that sexism needs to be fought only by females, period. Absolutely not. We have to all join together and fight against it. Yeah. What I'm talking about is for us in the ISO, I'm not talking about outside, but I'm talking about, yes, in the ISO, to have room to embrace meetings where females could meet by themselves and discuss things, and because of the advantages of being able to do that, not what is talked about there can't come out and be utilized in meetings where males and females meet together. Next thing, sexism, like racism, like any of this garbage, it's not a light switch. Whether we are no longer sexist or we are sexist, it's what I'm saying is it was mentioned that we are shaped by the conditions in which we live. Definitely, I believe that. Socialism definitely has the possibility to end sexism, but I also think because sexism's been with us so long, because sexism is so deeply ingrained in society that I think after the revolution, we are still going to have a huge amount of work weeding it out. Example, I think of myself as
30 seconds.
You know what? I don't need to go into the examples. Let's have other people talk.
Okay. Adrian?
Well, I guess I want to say first that I think the main reason that women in the ISO don't meet separately is because women in the ISO don't want to meet separately from our male comrades
That's
in the
right.
ISO. You know, I don't fault any of the women who, argue to break off from
some of the, you know, new left forces in the 60s and 70s because they were having sexist things shouted at them, or they were told to go make coffee or, you know, whatever. They had the right to do that and to organize to go be autonomous from the sexist organization that they were part of. But that is not what the ISO is. And so, you know, if the women in the ISO actually were demanding that, then that would actually be something to talk about. But that's how it's in front of us. That's actually something that's continually posed from outside based on sort of the, you know, both the memory of that experience in the 60s and 70s that women had, but also an idea that, like, the Marxism by itself doesn't actually provide an answer and an adequate, you know, response to sexism in society, a way to organize right now, or a way to actually get rid of sexism altogether. So, you know, that's on that. The other thing I really wanted to say is that I think that, like, this, the onslaught of pink, you know, that Jesse talked about a little bit, everything, and like, the separating out of the toys, the chicks, whatever, that was disgusting. Like, I think we should expect this to continue. Like, as the economic crisis continues to develop, like, I really think that a lot of that sort of, that real hard push to kind of separate people out, especially, you know, in response to seeing the LGBT movement, like, rise up and start to gain confidence, like, there will be a response from the other side. And I think that part of that response, you know, will actually be continued, you know, in the media and all around us, and so-called science and things like that. We'll continue to see that. And, you know, that will be resisted by the movement. And I think, I mean, I honestly don't know. I'll wrap up with this. Like, I don't know how you could, we could sit in a panel with the discussion that we were all in together about the fight against Prop 8 the other night and listen to what the experience was of our transgender comrade in One Struggle, One Fight, and talk about, like, what that meant to be fighting side by side with straight people in a multiracial, multi-age, like, you know, all what that meant to be fighting side by side, and say that what we really need to be talking about right now is figuring out how to divide ourselves up.
I have the man in the blue. That's no, behind you. Yeah, there you go. Hector.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
Sorry.
I didn't drag something away. So, I just, you know, thank you for the talk. It's really great. I had a very mechanical reactionary approach to sexism and how to fight it. I used to think, like, you know, we probably need to fight for socialism first, and then, you know, for sexism later. But it's like, no, you know, it's like, it's dialectical, it's very, you know, unitary, it's part and parcel of the fight. So that's really good, and of course, I'm still learning. Anyway, another thing, if you could share more examples of how men don't benefit from, like, it's kind of like there's white privilege and there's male privilege in that sense, right? So could you speak a bit more on that with examples? Because I, you know, I have some discussions with my friends and I usually lose to something over there. But anyway, I can think of more. Another thing is, we were just kind of trading notes right now, and maybe we should have, you know, polls on socialist work, or what are the top 10 things that have got after the revolution?
Now, even.
Right. Yeah. Or, you know, let's put stickers with every socialist worker. You get your sticker, you know, here.
All right. So I have this woman next, and then I have you in the second row after her, and Jillian will follow.
My name is Maitreya. I'm from San Diego. Forgive me if you've touched on this. I came a little late, but so you talk about the issue of abortion, access to abortion, but then lots of, like, literature has taken that even further and saying it's not just about having access to abortion or, you know, being pro, you know, having the option of, you know, choosing to have an abortion or not, but it's also, like, being able to, you know, have the option to have your kid, having the financial resources to be able to do that, and being supported by the government to be able to do that. And also, like, women of color studies, for example, takes it further and says, you know, the issue of pro-choice is also an issue of, like, forced sterilization for, like, poor women and women of color. And what that is a genocide on the poor people and a genocide on people of color. And basically, like, it just really gets to me because, like, I know, like, there was this campaign called the Crack campaign in the 90s, right? And basically what it was they would pay, like, women, poor women who were addicted to crack to have abortions. They'd give them, like, a couple hundred dollars or something. Like, how much was it? Something like that.
$300 to get the uterus taken out.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So just have, like, those are forced sterilizations. And what really upset me was that a few months ago, I even saw like some guy advocating this exact same thing as the crack campaign, and they're paying women like $300 to this day, like, to do something like that. And it's ridiculous because I know a little girl, like my best friend's adopted little sister, who was, you know, like a crack baby. She was addicted to crack when she was born. She's 5 years old now. She's one of the most healthy little girls like I've ever met. And the fact that, you know, like, we are taking these children's lives, that's not okay. And the fact that they're babies when you know, they're addicted to crack, it's so much easier to cure that than to cure an adult from, like, being addicted to crack, because they're not addicted emotionally or psychologically, just physically.
Yeah.
And we're just basically sweeping that problem under the rug and saying, you know, like, you know, these children are poor, like, you know, we don't care about them, as opposed to, like, just taking, like, not that much time to, you know, cure, like, a crack baby. It's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So that's all.
So, in order to get everyone who wants to speak, I'm going to cut it to 2 minutes now, just so everybody knows. So try and keep that in mind, and I'll give you a 30-second marker, and you're next.
Okay. I'm Claire. I just wondered if someone could maybe explain to me a little bit more about how the ISO, like, what's the word, would address the issue of difference after class, like, class society is eliminated. I think anywhere you have difference, whether it's gender difference, male, female, transgender, racial difference, you have the potential for oppression and the potential for violence. And how would a post-class society address these issues and keep them in check? And some people have tried to answer that for me by saying that the experience of fighting together for this revolution is going to change people, that it's going to, it really, I'm sorry if this is a little bit inflammatory, but it reminds me of, it sounds a little bit like a religious experience to me, like there will be a transformation. Going through this experience together will transform people. I think that people can be transformed. I don't think that it's permanent. I think
30 seconds.
A lot of what I've heard here doesn't take into account the complexity of the human mind. It doesn't take into account a set of personal ethics and of morality that is independent of class. I'll just wrap up with this. We've seen in communes that have rejected classes without a money system, persistence of sexual exploitation, where women have come out of this and said, you know, I felt sexually exploited even though there was no class, there was no money system, I wasn't property, but I still felt exploited. I mean, how is that? That's just one example, but how is that addressed?
Okay, Jillian, who will be followed by, I think you.
Let's see. I changed a little bit what I was going to talk about. I'm Jillian from LA. Let's see. Really quick on the question of men don't benefit. Think about a couple in which your female partner is paid less, doesn't really have the ability to terminate a pregnancy if she wants to, and has no access to quality child care and stuff. That all of those things actually make life harder for that, for the man and for the family as well. They don't actually help his life, they actually make it more difficult. In terms of the question of difference persisting sort of even in a struggle and after a revolution, I mean, a commune that tries to create some kind of a classless society in the midst of a capitalist system with all of these oppressive images and and norms is actually more likely to replicate it. That's very different than a struggle where we go up against, confront together, up against those structures. And one of the reasons I believe socialism will begin the process of ending women's oppression is because women are going to be in the forefront of that struggle, like they've been in the forefront of the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. And why all commentators around strikes are always shocked about, wow, the women were just getting right up in the cops' faces and stuff like that, because women have gone to the forefront. And that does change the thoughts of the men that live with them and see them in the home every day. That totally transforms their view of what their female comrades are going to be able to do. Last thing, really quick, I wanted to bring up, like, imagining where we could collectivize the work that is given to women unpaid in the home and collectivized childcare and kind of what some of that could look like. Because we're taught that we only have to care about our own little nuclear family. But in things like the Lawrence strike, the strikers actually took care of the children of other strikers in another city so that they could win their strike. When you're in a movement, you start to have a bigger sense of who we're responsible for. And I wanted people to think a bit more about how we could reconceptualize that in a future society.
So from now on, I'm just going to tap on the table because it seems kind of distracting when I say 30 seconds for people. So you in the back with the glasses and black shirt, and then Todd will be after him.
Hi, I'm Brandy from Los Angeles as well. I want to make two points that they kind of show the intermeshing of sexism and class issues. One, I gave a talk on socialism in Sweden, and one part of the research I did was actually look into the social welfare programs in places like Sweden and France and, you know, many places around the world. And a big part of it is, I think, like, you know, maternity leave, paternity leave, child care programs, elder care. A lot of the benefits of those sorts of programs are actually steps towards the socialist demand of collectivizing that unpaid labor of women in the homes. Like, these programs that, you know, were fought for and won by basically the working classes in those countries to get a little bit of a better shake from the system for their families, had a specific direct connection, you know, in terms of a different way of taking care of people instead of just, you know, putting it unpaid on women's shoulders. And I think it's probably telling that a lot of the right wing opposition to those societies refer to the system as the nanny state. You know, society isn't supposed to take care of children or take care of the sick. You know, you just get a nanny state to do that for you, you know, so that you don't have to think about it anymore. And then the other thing is that I'm a school teacher, and obviously, you know, there's been strides taken in terms of fighting sexism and, you know, facing teachers, facing nurses, but teaching and nursing are still, you know, predominantly female professions, and the model of how those are organized is still kind of the same thing, where it's like teachers and nurses are overwhelmingly and consistently expected to be very self-sacrificing for their students or for their patients, and, you know, right, the lowest paid professions, of course. Mm-hmm. And so even though it's we can say it's a good thing and it's advanced that there are more male teachers, more male nurses, more women in traditionally male professions, the underfunding of healthcare, the underfunding of education, the attacks on salaries for teachers and nurses is something that's clearly both an attack on the working class broadly and a specific manifestation of sexism at the same time.
Okay. After Todd, I have Dana, and then I have you up here in the front. And I know it seems like a long time before I'm getting to people, but there were like 20 people who raised their hands immediately when I opened the list. So be patient. Go ahead, Todd. Sorry.
Well, I just want to start by thanking Jesse for introducing a serious discussion of purity balls. very important. I wanted to back up what Adrian said about the internal structure of revolutionary organization. We believe that women have as much to contribute on the questions of theory and economics and in history as men do. We believe that men have something to contribute to discussions about women's liberation. We believe that straight people have something to learn from and contribute to a discussion about LGBT liberation. We believe that white, black, Latino, Asian people have something to contribute about a discussion about how we smash all forms of racism. That makes us different than a lot of other types of organizations, and that's an argument we make. You want to have an effective revolutionary party that can actually fight in the working class to overcome these divisions. You need to figure out how to build that unity within your own organization. Now, if you've got gigantic problems in your organization and you have to do something different, then do it. But I believe that the ISO has made great strides and will continue to make great strides. Anybody who wants to know whether or not women can be leaders not only in the coming revolution, but in the practical day-to-day struggle now, only has to look at the women leadership in the ISO. So I'd say that. Secondly, just on the question of will the revolution solve everything? I mean, I think... the communes. Like, if you just try to separate off, that the commune will end up reproducing the ills of capitalist society. So the revolutionary process is actually necessary to go through and smash it. So, for instance, think about, you know, women with guns and, you know, being part of the workers' militia. Are they going to put up with the sexist? No, because you aren't. And you need to cement that revolution with actually massive economic changes. So free abortion on demand, equal pay. You give all the women a raise so that they've got equal pay. Massive influx into all trades and all professions. You eliminate by the revolutionary process, and then you cement with a change in the economic structure by communalizing childcare, by communalizing all the housework, etc., by making women, by eliminating the physical aspects of women's oppression, that it becomes the economic basis of a new society.
Dana, followed by Adrian from San Diego in the front.
Yeah, so congrats, Jesse, for giving me the core of the weekend, which is Battle Where We Stand, because I think that is, like, an ongoing theme. And I will be honest, like, looking at the last 25 years, we stand in a pretty crappy situation around women's rights issues, which is, I think, why sometimes discussions can be a little bit abstract, because there's not much to look at in terms of the fight. I mean, it's an onslaught of sexism and very little in return. I mean, the fact that pro-life people can come to San Francisco march every year is horrifying. And we should be horrified by it. But we are also, we are on the precipice, I think, of actually a real new era. I mean, I hate that I keep using the quote from the do that for a new era. But I really do think class issues are on the agenda in a big way now, in a way that they haven't been in 25 years or more. And I think it's a really important thing for us to say that. Class issues, though, aren't necessarily issues of, you know, fighting oppression. And I think what we have to start doing, and what it's, you know, our obligation as socialists is to link up the class fight with a real fight against oppression. Because it is right now, there is not a major fight against women's oppression happening. And we need to be the initiators of it, but we also, where there is fight, we need to pitch those battles against sexism, too. So, for example, the fight for healthcare that is looming in this country right now, that is just now getting started, we need to insert into that fight a demand for abortions.
Right?
That's a clearly important issue. It's not going to necessarily be brought up. Okay? And it's up to us in this room to really start to link up those issues around oppression, and particularly women's oppression. And in terms of male privilege and the whole... the massive privatization of the family, you know, that is not benefiting working class people. We need to actually bring some of those issues around the oppression of families, you know, into this class fight that I think we are actually starting to wage. And so, you know, it is up to us to kind of be the tribune of the oppressed. And what that means, I think, is in this new era, talking about class issues and linking them up explicitly with the fight for women's rights. Because we are not in a good position right now. And we need to be in a better position. The only way to do that is to start to really make the arguments.
All right, Adrian in the front, and then... the woman with the orchid in her hair, back there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm Adrian from San Diego, and I really appreciated the comments about how forced sterilization is a form of genocide. I also wanted to speak to that a little bit because there has been I was a clinic escort in Detroit, and there's a lot of the right wing and, like, you know, crazy fanatics saying that abortion is black genocide. And, you know, there's kind of, like, twisting of the history of access to abortion, saying that it's like, marketed to people of color. But, I mean, obviously, the lack of access to abortion for poor women, which is disproportionately African American and Latina, is a form of violence against women. That would be closer to the fact that after the Hyde Amendment, when Medicare was denied to women, the first reported woman who died of a botched abortion because she couldn't raise the money to get it herself was Rosie Jimenez, a single mother. I'm really excited about Sharon Smith's article that we cannot be like the liberals and capitulate to the right and fetishize fetuses and call them children. Mm-hmm. We have to, frankly, it's the same societal ills that erase women from the picture, that dehumanize them, that make rape possible, that make it possible to refer to women as bitches and whores and sluts and say rape jokes with impunity in my law school. Is the same that erases women from the picture on the issue of abortion. And I have no dramatic way to end it.
When the next speaker is speaking, I'm actually going to be taking a last round of hands. We have about 15 minutes, 10, 15 minutes left for discussion, so I'm probably going to cut it back to a minute and a half as well. So try to keep your comments under that. And I'm sorry. Go on.
Okay. My name is Veronica. Hi. Sadina and Adrian went exactly where I was going, way better than I probably could. So I started out all my theoretical knowledge about feminism, and now I'm a socialist because I don't need to tell you guys in the room that mainstream feminism sucks a lot in America. It's a gay capitalism club. Naomi Wolf is a really good example because she wrote The Beauty Myth, and now she's gone totally crazy and is writing all these things about how Angelina Jolie, her colonialism is awesome. So it's terrible. But I think that in feminism, we've lost a lot of ground because we've let the dialogue be taken over by this yay capitalism club. We're supposed to feel sorry for women being oppressed because they can't be CEOs when all of the other women, lower, 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 get erased from the entire thing. And I think it's up to us to take back space in that dialogue. I'm sure I'm not the only person who's really sad that the word feminism gets written off by everyone who's really important. It's an important label to have. It's a good movement for us. But it gets written off by both sides, either as a bourgeois pursuit or as something that's like not as important to the revolution. But we need that space, and we need to take it.
I have Ashley, followed by the blue shirt and gray sweatshirt in the fourth row.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to how I think, especially with like the economic crisis, like the demand for women's rights and the demand for working class rights are actually inextricably linked. A few months ago, or I think it was 2 months ago or so, I think it was Reuters put out a report saying that women are soon going to surpass men as the largest percentage in the U.S. workforce because of many of the job losses coming from traditional male-dominated sectors like manufacturing. And so I think actually like this points to how like actually increasingly men, because men are part of working class families as well, are going to need to be part of the demand for a raise of women's wages as that's what most many working class families are coming to rely on. And I think it's like really, it's also like important. I think the sister over here brought up a good point that sometimes the idea that, people's ideas change during struggle can seem like maybe that's a religious kind of thing. But I think also you have to realize that that's made up of like moments. That's made up of political arguments. Like I've had some of the best political arguments I've ever had that were won very quickly around people not using like gender negative language, calling people the B word or the F word, actually came, on picket lines, striking with, garbage workers and making the argument to them that that's what we shouldn't be calling the scabs because, that's, that undermines our solidarity with each other. And, it was those moments that actually changed that. And I think alongside actually making systemic changes to, the conditions that create sexism, I highly point anyone who, questions, whether or not, difference inherently breeds oppression, to check out myths of male dominance, because you can learn about all the indigenous societies pre-capitalism where actually we didn't see the same structures, where actually, Cherokee councils had total representation of women and men.
Okay. So then I have you, and then I have Amanda, and then I have Matt. So go ahead.
Okay. My name's Anita. I'm a radical woman here in San Francisco. Francisco, and I appreciate the comprehensive talk that you gave about sexism and what we're experiencing right now. I'm a socialist feminist. I think that there is still a sexism on the left, and that we need to foster a lot more support for women to fight against it and also build women's leadership. I'm a Trotskyist, and Leon Trotsky said, look to the women and the youth. So that's something that is really important to me, that, you know, ever since I was 16, I was part of a movement where my leadership was really fostered, where, you know, me as a queer person, my opinions and experiences were really valued. So I think that's what we really need to be doing, and I agree that some people have been saying about how after the revolution, we'll still need to be working against sexism, against homophobia, against racism, and that's that whole concept of permanent revolution, and hopefully that we can get there to that point where everything is, we may have a classless society, we may have a, I don't know, even a genderless society, we don't even know, but we could still be moving forward and evolving as humanity, and that's what the beauty of socialist feminism is about.
Okay, I'm sorry, I messed up the list, so I have Amanda, and then you are after her.
I think that I think that those things are important as well. I mean, I invite folks to look at even just like the schedule of this conference, and look at like the list of the speakers and even the final panels and who it is that has been featured. And I think that it's like you can look at our organization and say that those things about women's leadership, gender diversity, and all sorts of identities to be realized and fostered is very much a part of what we do as well. And the thing that I wanted to actually get to that hadn't been addressed was, I mean, you had put forward kind of like the idea it might be a spiritual experience, or like after we have a revolution, like there's a morality exists outside of the structure that we have in terms of like capitalism or how we understand things. And I would actually put forward, like, I don't think we do. Trotsky wrote a book called Their Morals Are Ours, and I think that what, you know, I won't go into it, he was writing about a lot of different things, but what I think I would want to put forward is that the way that we understand these, like, the society that we have sort of shapes how it is that we then understand what it is that is acceptable or not acceptable. So, for instance, like, if you even look at, like, crime, which is kind of like, there was, I don't remember the name of the guy, he killed, like, three of his wives in Texas, and got off scot-free, like, he wasn't even charged, and yet Texas is the country, like, it is the country, it's the state that actually has, like, the most amount of people amongst in the world, right? And yet, so, like, how does he get off scot-free for being a murderer, and yet, whatever, like, why do CEOs get off scot-free, but, like, the rest of us who are working class, like, get charged with all manner of things, like, you get 25 years to life for three strikes, like, whatever. So, I mean, I'm just trying to, I don't have a ton of time to go into it, but I think we have to ask, where does the oppression come from, and is it rooted outside of that society or not? So, I mean, let's talk about it more.
All right, we have only time for three more speakers, so I'm sorry if you raise your hand a second time, I can't have you speak. So you, and then followed by Matt, and Diane will actually be our last speaker.
I'm Dan from the LAISO branch. I just like to give Matt props to two women in here who have led marches of 100 students in demanding end to the budget cuts. And the legalization of 12 million undocumented people. And that's Miriam Daniel from the LA branch, and that's the Walmart Joseph. Walmart team also led the first racist checkpoint response in the city of Pomona, which, like, really started the whole movement in Pomona, and she's really pissed off a lot of cops for that reason. For now, I'm proud to work with her for internal rights and for socialism.
Yeah.
I actually had a question, which I was kind of hoping to get out of here sooner, but hopefully maybe Jesse can address it. It was something that was actually brought up during the sexual identity and socialism talk, but we never, like, got an opportunity to answer there either. And it's about, like, how you make a Marxist argument against strip clubs or pornography in general, and because the thing that's put out there is that it's a form of exploitation, sure, but it's no different than any other, like, form of exploitation under the capitalist system. And in fact, like, for some people, they see it, especially after, like, postmodern feminism and all that bullshit, as a way of making, like, more if Wade being more successful, making more money, he would be able to make another career. I don't think it's even true, but like, there's that image put out there. So how do you like make an argument that, you know, it's actually a horrible form of sexist exploitation without like sounding like you're trying to introduce some kind of morality, Victorian morality towards it? So I just want to put that out there as a interest.
Diane, and then you can actually come back.
Diane from Portland. First of all, I'm really excited that there are so many people in this room. Personal experience, I had a friend who was transgender, just beautiful lady. She committed suicide a few years ago because just society just fucked her up. She was raped in prison. After that, somehow the government considered her disabled. Paid for all her hormone therapy, did not address any of her emotional, psychological issues, her drug addiction. So I think that we are going to have so many issues to face, social services, things like that in the future. And why aren't these things being addressed right now by the government?
Okay, and then you will be our last speaker.
Okay, and I'll hand it back. Adrian, I just wanted to say that actually, there is a historical materialist explanation for the abortion races or abortion targets, black women. Actually, Margaret Sanger, who started Planned Parenthood,
that's right.
Right, she started out as a socialist and then ended up getting sucked into the eugenics movement, where actually it was offering abortions and birth control and sterilization to women of color. And second of all, I just wanted to say, I guess I shouldn't have added that commune thing on at the end, because what I was trying to say was taking into account, or even assuming, the conditions of worldwide revolution, let's just say we have the whole planet, I still believe that, and I don't think anyone here could disagree with this, and I don't think they would. There's still going to be people who believe that life begins at conception. There's still going to be people who don't want to be in a global communal society with people who don't believe that. With people who, there are people who believe that homosexuality is an aberration and it's the result of societal conditions. Just like socialists believe that a lot of the crime and the aberrations that we see, what we believe are aberrations, are a result of this society. And so there you go.
All right, I'm going to hand it back to Jesse to wrap up. And just right before that, I'm going to announce everyone should go and check out the Haymarket Bookstore over in the women's building. We're in the women's building. I have dyslexia today. So, in 110 Cap Street. And really check out these books. I mean, I'm sure Jesse's going to talk about them in her wrap-up, but Women in Socialism is essential. If you have not read it, you really, really should. And also, if you can get a copy of Alexander Kollontai's works and have them to read on you at all times, that's excellent. She talks a lot about what happened after the Russian Revolution. You probably heard in other talks they legalized gay marriage, women were freed up from the work in the home, all that stuff. And it's actually online at Marxist.org as well. And sexuality and socialism, you all know, is essential. So also, remember to join us today for the rally, The Return of Socialism, featuring Sharon Smith today at 1 p.m. and Todd in the Women's Building. And if you would like to become a member of the International Socialist Organization or to learn more about what it means to join the ISO, the ISO recruitment desk is open during lunch near the registration tables at both Cap Street and in the Women's Building. Make sure that you still have your badge to get into the sessions. And that's it.
Okay. Okay, so there are some good books. Reviving Ophelia is a good book. Schoolgirls is a good book. There's a whole ton of books about trying to raise girls and young women in our extraordinarily fucked up society. And I know that a lot of the examples I used were they're so ludicrous you have to laugh, but none of this is funny. Yeah. None of it's funny. It's all like damaging. It's economically damaging to women. It's psychologically damaging to women. It caused your friend to commit suicide. All these gender norms and all this pressure. It's horrible, and it needs to be addressed in every form. And I think one of the biggest problems we have is how you're so used to sexism, yet you're like, oh, for Christ's sake, you know? And it's like that. That's the response. I mean, that's my response, you know, 50 times a day. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? On this, you know, on like kids shows or whatever, you know, or on the sides of buses, whatever. But I think that's what we need to flip, is that sort of like internalized, it's demoralizing. We need to turn it around. I mean, we need a movement. We're not a day away from, you know, the stickers, and which I do love. I love that you did that. I think that's very cool. My sister and I did that in high school once too, when this really awful movie came out. But it's like, it's really, there is, we need to build a movement, but I think we also need to, just call out sexism when we see it, because it just gets so sickening. I think the question, I think the question of how men don't benefit was handled pretty well. I think it was handled, and if people didn't feel like it was handled, we can talk about it later. I just want to, I know I don't have a lot of time. I think the thing about, you know, people will be different after a revolution, there will be differences. Yes, there will be. That's the whole point of the Kinsey quote I use. We have a continuum of possibilities. There's shit we haven't even thought of, which will be awesome under socialism. You know, there's stuff we don't even, you know, but that's why they say, that's why I wanted to talk about this on two levels. One is, there is a transformative effect of struggle. I do believe that that's true. I also believe it doesn't always have to be permanent. If you don't follow it up with actual concrete economic and policy changes, like raising women's wages, saying, you know, no, we are actually going to, you know, not let you put these objective posters of women up or whatever, you know, like my son, you know, your top 10 things that you want to ban under the revolution, that there actually have to be policy changes. There have to be changes that immediately impact people's lives, like the nurseries and the communal kitchens and the laundries and stuff like that. And it will take, as Engels said, a generation, maybe two, before all these ideas are shed. It's not an immediate thing. That's one of the, State and Revolution was a book that Lenin wrote, where he talks about a whole process that you have to go through to go from capitalism, smashing the state, reorganizing society. It's going to be, you know, generations before people don't have knee-jerk, you know, before people don't have all these all this baggage that we have now. But I also think that there will be differences. There will be gender differences. I'm for a gender-free society, absolutely. Dress however you want, do whatever you want, don't hurt anybody. And let, you know, unless that's your thing. But, you know what I'm saying. But I think that the thing of, there will be people who, you know, have ideas against abortion. Well, this is what Wanda Sykes says. Don't have one. You don't like same-sex marriage? Don't marry someone of the same sex. I mean, that's funny. It's a funny bit. But I also think that you have to look at, where do those ideas come from and why do they exist? They exist to codify the nuclear family. The whole image, a lot of the images, a lot of the definition of what is homosexual is a social construct. If we can take apart the social construct, then we can take away some of those ideas. If people, you know, why is it promoted and poor? Like, I don't think it's promoted, but the thing about the forced sterilization, and eugenics, that's a really fucked up part of our history. And it's really insane, but it does show that there's a real hypocrisy there. You know, we want to deny women abortion, but we actually kind of want to make sure that these people don't keep it. It's a really fucked up thing. Let's take those social pressures and that social construct away. And I truly do not think that people want to oppress each other. I think society pits us against each other, and there are structures which force us to compete, but I do not think that in a socialist society of free association and free love, is a sort of the phrases that Alexander Kollontai lives, that people will have it in their interest to build structures that oppress each other. I truly don't believe that. You know, that's for the future generations to work out, but I do not believe, I think that those are social constructs. The pornography in strip clubs, that's a very interesting question. This is what I would say. I mean, there's policies we'll implement after the revolution, but yeah, I'm not for going around picketing strip clubs. What I would say is that women and men who work in strip clubs or in the sex industry need to be free from harm. Yes. They need to be in safe conditions. Yeah. They need to be unionized by SEIU like they did at the Lusty Lady. Yeah. They're a union, place. And that's how I would address it. I think that people should be free to do what they want, but if someone feels forced to, they make more money at a strip club than they would waiting tables. We do not criticize them for that. We say you need to be safe in your workplace, and I think I hope that begins to answer your question. That's how I would look at it. And I guess the last thing I would say is I think that the question of differences is really the thing. I guess I'll admit that this book, Sherry's book, really started getting me thinking. I think that it's society that actually quashes our differences and punishes us for our differences.
Right.
And I think if you go back to the question of a continuum, and it's people being able to exist whichever identity, whatever colors, however you want to dress, however you want to identify, however you want to organize your interpersonal relationships, get the state out of there. And I think that's the flowering of humanity. I think that we now have, you're straight, and if you're not straight, please just be regular old gay, and if you're not, I mean, that's what we've got. And I think that we crack that open, have a continuum, and that's what I think we would really flower in our differences versus feel really pushed into little boxes that are much more oppressive.